Hello, everyone. Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation today and spend some time with you. Given the dramatic lighting, I hope we can still keep this relatively informal. I've been on sabbatical this year, hence this is my idea of formal wear. But a lot of it has been going around speaking about the topic that I'm doing today. And when you do a lot of speaking, you end up going into sort of certain routines. So I do the Baptist preacher, life change, let's go speech, and we do the nerd technology, inductive reasoning speech. But when I was looking at today and looking at the different things on the agenda and looking at the group who's going to be here, I thought we should really spend some time on some pragmatic and practical questions of how we can look at social networking and technology in terms of how we do social networking, but I'm going to actually spend some time on why we should do social networking. Given that I give lots of speeches, you end up saying, what's the title of your talk, Dave? How about that? And then, of course, 3 months later when you're actually about to come, you figure out what the real title is. So the real title for today is the same old story, everything is different. As I look around this and I look at a lot of the discussion surrounding social networking in libraries and library 2.0 and this 2.0 and that 2.0, it's interesting that the minute you talk about how revolutionary the world is, in whatever context, so let's take the technology context, it's an invitation to instantaneously invite this other group of people who will automatically disagree with you. Right? Now, in academia, we're used to this, where you say things like, isn't it a nice day? Someone says, no, it's not. Let's argue to the truth. But the idea that somehow Library 2.0 and Web 2.0 and all this is radically new and radically different, and we have new societies, and the millennials have brains that are different than ours, and they have better thumb uses than pointer fingers, and somehow this means that we're going to evolve into different species. Reminds me a lot of Socrates, who used to talk about these damn kids these days don't really get it. So libraries are used to change, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And so what I want to get to is I want to get to this concept of participatory librarianship, which is what we've been spending time on. And it's founded on this first concept, that knowledge is created through conversation. You can even say knowledge is in the conversation. And that libraries, being in the knowledge business, are therefore in the conversation business. And I'm going to break that down into much more detail for a moment. But what I want to do is when you look at this, you're sort of like, okay. And you realize that this isn't radically new. I mean, we can go way back, right? The idea that somehow we set up dialectic arguments and we argue to the truth, as I mentioned before, talked about the power of conversation, the idea that we get together and we talk and we develop and understand the world through this interactive dialogue. Well, if we take that a little bit towards the near future, we can look at Raghunathan and his famous laws, and we can go through the first four, and I bet if he was alive today, he wouldn't even use the word book in most of them because of this last law, that the library is a growing organism, that libraries are about change. So when we talk about the internet radically changing libraries, I think we can easily say, well, that's one factor of change. I would argue that one of the equal factors of change for both academic, public, and special libraries is the fact that in the past century, the average lifespan has gone from 44 to 78. That massive shift in demographics in this country is going to have a huge impact on how we educate, how we offer services, in what mode we offer services. That kind of radical change is also a factor. And if we go further back, we can talk about the moving of libraries from chained libraries to removing the chains to OpenStax. We could go further back and talk about moving from manuscripts into printed things. We could go way back and talk about moving from stone tablets to this great new technology called papyrus. Oh, these kids these days, they don't understand the value of stone tablets. The point is that we evolve. And what I want to say about this is the reason that we have libraries over centuries being relevant is not the fact that they didn't change. It was the fact that they did. That they had the capability of changing. And I also want to posit to you that change isn't inevitable and isn't even necessarily natural. That what it took was a dedicated group of individuals at some point to change it. It took a group to consciously say, we are going to make a change. I'm always a little annoyed, frankly, at when I talk to different groups and librarians talk about, well, if only our library wasn't this way. Our library is too static. Our library is too this, and our library is too that. And I just want to stop and say, aren't you your library? I mean, this concept that somehow because we put the stacks on the shelves in this configuration, that is the natural way of it. In library science education, we deal a lot with theory, and people say, well, we don't have theory in library science. You know, so it would be like talking about the theory of General Motors. But we do have a larger theory of how people work and how people interact and how people learn to guide us. Ultimately, I'll give you the last slide first. When we look at change, we are the ones who are going to absorb it and make it and control it, or else we will be the victims of it. But I want to work on this library as a growing organism. This notion of conversation, to bring it into a much more recent, this is Joan Bechtel writing in College and Research Libraries. As more powerful alternative to the images of librarianship already available or proposed, I suggest that we begin to think of libraries as centers of conversations and ourselves as mediators of the participants in the conversations of the world. This is 1986. This is one of my favorite, you know, future casting, right next to Bob Taylor when he wrote 1968, once we get over these little hiccups of library automation, life will be good. Right, 1968. 40 years later, my kids are still dealing with hiccups. And what she was talking about is when we teach information literacy and we talk about librarianship, oftentimes we concentrate on bibliographic instruction, and this is pretty futile. She goes, what's interesting is look at scholarly communication. In an academic setting, what we do is our publications are an ongoing conversation, and if we can teach students to really understand that and not see them as these static items sitting on a shelf, we could be better. Now, the example I put up here, this is a book of law from Italy in the 14th century, and this is the law, these two columns right here. And what happens is people are annotating or glossing the law, saying what it means and how to interpret it. And what's interesting about this is a conversation going on. It's a conversation going on with pen and ink and quills, but it's a conversation. So this concept that somehow the web invented conversation, let's get over that real quick. Right? What we're talking about through annotations, through citations, through how the information works, is we're talking about supporting conversations. Now, if we want to go a little bit further back, this is the Babylonian Talmud. And here is, well, let me make it highlight it. Here is the entry, the testament, if you will. And then these are different scholars who, over time, began commenting on the text, commenting on the comments, commenting on information. This is like the world's first wiki, right? The Talmud should be called the Babylonian wiki of our era, right? I mean, it's really scary to think that, you know, the wiki is somehow more profound. But anyway, that's what this is. This is a conversation. And if you look throughout your libraries, you're finding tons of conversations. Now, I went back and forth when we originally titled the technology brief, The Library's Conversation, because people said, well, conversations are two people sitting down having an informal chat. And we said, the dictionary said that. I said, the dictionary also says that a dictionary is a bound thing with paste and thread. And I just looked that definition up on my Oxford English Dictionary online. Right? The dictionary can change. So I'm going to bring one other quick point out, which is the context in which Bechtel was talking about this was, perhaps it is an overstatement to say that academic librarians are drifting in a vast sea of information and technological advances, searching for an appropriate course of action. Nevertheless, we appear to have lost the stabilizing rudder of confidence in who we are and what we do. 1986. Right? Throw the word Google in there, and we could probably see that 5 years ago. I would say that was 5 years ago. I would say these days when we look at our future and our thread, we're not quite so hysterical about it. So I want to walk back and talk a little bit about where I started, which was that knowledge is created through a conversation. And this is, when I look at social networking tools and when I look at how we use technology in the classroom, when I look at that road forward, these are the signs that I use. Because I'm really convinced that if we constantly keep trying to grab the next, whatever the hot technology is, we will always be the second best incorporator of that technology. Trying to beat Google at being Google is a losing game. Trying to beat Amazon at being Amazon is a losing game. First of all, they're not in the same business. Google is in the advertising business, and Amazon's in the thing business. We are in the knowledge business, and therefore, conversations. So what do I mean by conversation? It's not a metaphor. I mean, literally, knowledge is created through conversation. So when I look at should we do wikis, should we do blogs, should we do these things, I come back to saying, well, what's the purpose here? Is the purpose knowledge creation? And what does that mean? So when you're talking about a conversation, you have the conversants. You have the language that they exchange back and forth. You have agreements that they make throughout it. And you have something called an entailment mesh, which is a fancy way of saying a memory of agreements. So I'm going to walk through that, and I want to talk about the implications for library systems on that. So let's start with the conversants. Two or more cognitive agents. Oh, God, cognitive agents. Dave came down from the ivory tower to bring us this crap. Okay? Well, here's the problem. Here's why people use agents. People use the word agents because there's no other good word for it. You could say two or more conversing things, but people don't understand that. Are we talking people here? Well, when Pask was talking about conversants, and when he was talking about, Pask developed this thing called conversation theory as an attempt to teach machines to think. And the idea was, we're going to use how people think and try and teach machines that way. We're going to use natural intelligence until artificial intelligence catches up. And so he looked at people and how they conversed, but what he did is he said, all right, when people are having this conversation, they can have it one-to-one. They can have it one-to-a-group. They can have it group-to-group. Right? So, for example, when you sat down and negotiated your last contract with a vendor, you were two agents, a library and a vendor, having a conversation. You were seeking agreements, all of that. You could say that treaties are different countries having conversations and coming to agreements. And Pask went the other way. He said, you can have conversations within your own head. I mean, he was really, literally talking about the idea that when you see that, your ears talk to your eye and say, did I just hear the same thing? Yes, we agree. But it also comes, this isn't that crazy, because if you've ever been to critical thinking or information literacy, you know things like critical thinking, metacognition. You probably did it this morning. Well, if I go this way, I'm stuck in traffic, but if I go this way, I can stop at the donut stand, and if I go this way, I can have coffee. Boy, does this make me look fat.
Yes.
And all these things. That's a conversation you're having internally. So a conversant isn't just necessarily two people. It's two things, whether it's within me, outside of me, or the organizations. And these two agents have to be paying attention. This is really important. They have to be paying attention. This is not Fox News. It doesn't work that way. Right? You have to go back and forth. You have to take turns. And when you do it, you have to listen and respond. There's a turn-taking thing. And the conversation occurs over time. That time could be seconds. That time could be millennia. One could argue that we are engaged in a constant conversation about what is our purpose in life. One could talk about the idea that we started out hundreds of years ago. We're still having a conversation with that Melville Dewey started on what is effective and efficient library service. Now, these conversants are sending language back and forth. More ivory tower. I give these terms to you not because they mean anything, but because you can impress your friends with them. And we have someone working on a live scribe, and I think it would be cool to go back and see if this works. This language going back and forth between the conversants is either L0 versus L1.
What does that mean?
What that means is L0 language is, I don't know what you're talking about. You're the expert, you're the teacher, I'm stupid. So the language, the interchange that we could have, it's like me talking about a good restaurant in Brooklyn. It's not going to be a fun conversation. Well, I went to a sushi place last night. Anything else? I don't know, right? Versus someone who lives here who says, well, what kind of food do you want? Where are you going? They ask a lot of questions, right? That's an L0 conversation, which is best you can be directional. Think of it as really bad training. Have you ever been in bad technology training where they say, click here, then click here, then click here? And you're like, why? You're like, no, click here, then click here, then click here. That's L0 language. The best you can be is directional, functional. Once you have two conversants that truly understand the domain they're talking about, then you get an L1 language, right? Now what you're doing is you're talking about whys. Instead of what and where and how, you start talking about why do we do that? What's going on? So we can have within this group a very L1 conversation about librarianship, because I can throw out terms like classification. And I can have a pretty good confidence that people understand that concept and I don't have to spend time explaining it. Now, where this comes in is actually in the notion of conversations versus classification, which is this language use. Libraries are embedded with language use. Think about the Dewey Decimal Classification. Think about the Library of Congress subject heading. Think about the Getty Art Thesaurus. These are language. They're negotiated uses of language. And then we ask, how ready are people to use them? So when you have someone who understands these really well, they're amazingly effective and efficient. You can navigate and move through the Eric Thesaurus left and right if you understand what the concepts are. But to people who don't have that understanding, they're gobbledygook. They're categories. We make them hierarchical and we think that that's self-explanatory. See also is a really bizarre concept to someone. Right?
And so what you get is libraries understand this, but they oversimplify. And the example I give is imagine if you go into Grand Central at rush hour, and I told you to capture every conversation going on. What would you do? Besides go nuts. What you would do is tell everyone to stop. The first thing you would do is you would make the environment static. The second thing is you would begin to subdivide it. Because you can't hear it all at once. You say, business conversations over here, pleasure conversations over here. Business lawyers over here, doctors over here, right? And you keep breaking it down until you've got a manageable group, and then you could go to a little group and say, what were you talking about? And you could record it. Now, I want to give you a radically different metaphor that technology enables. Right now, there are millions of conversations going on in this very room. If you have one of these, even if it's on mute or turned off, it's talking back and forth to the tower going, and it calls for me, right? If you have a BlackBerry, it's pushing emails at you. Right now, WPLJ is pumping music through you, right? Radio waves are coursing through your body as we speak. All of these having people talking at or to each other, but they don't get in the way of this conversation. What we can use is a special piece of technology, a phone, a radio, what have you, to tune into the conversation that we need. We can even co-locate them if they're not next to each other. We can begin to say, I want that conversation. You don't have to stop the rest of it. So in cataloging, we talk about the idea of reduction of noise in the catalog. We want to get rid of noise in the catalog. Catalogs should be very noisy places. But we need good tools to filter out the noise we don't want. Right? So what this leads to is a couple of different kinds of systems. Static systems, learning systems, and participatory systems. Static systems are where someone comes in and they operate at one or the other levels and they can't migrate. In other words, if I come and start using your system, the system does not teach me what the domain is. Learning systems, which is what PASS worked on, is a system that takes you from here to here. So as you use the system through tutorials or through online system help, it moves you up to an L1 language. And I'm going to talk about participatory learning in a second. Let me show you the best classic example of a static L0 system. Ready? You thought I was going to show a catalog, didn't you? Yes, by the way, your catalog is here too. But think about this interface. Think about this interface that we have spent 10 years trying to copy. Right? Remember before when Yahoo taught us that the entire world had to be subdivided into 13 categories and no more and no less? Right? Now we're trying to do this. How does this system help you get better? It doesn't. Now, if you come into the system with an L0 understanding of the world, you type things like education, you type things like New York in here, right? And it gives you what you deserve, which is a lot of crap. Right? But if you know what you're doing, if you're already in an L1 system, I can use pluses and minuses and quote signs and tildes and link to colon, right? It's dialogue. This is a dialogue search box, right? But it doesn't allow the L0s to migrate up to the L1. It doesn't say, hey, try this, try that, try this. It just takes what you give it and spits it out. The closest it gets is a spell check. Did you mean this? Right? But this is a classic static system. What do I mean by a learning system? Gaming is now a learning system. If you look at what's happening in gaming, you got a game of any sort of heft to it. It used to come with a manual that looked like War and Peace. Right? If you wanted to be the Donkey Kong King, you read the manual on how to jump at the right time. Now, the most complex games come with a manual that's about that thick that says hit W to go forward. Right? Because what's happening in gaming is they realize that the first level of any game is the tutorial. But they don't call it the tutorial anymore. They give you a very specified task and they teach you what you're doing. Right? And so Myst, I was a big Myst fan. I lost many an hour to Myst. Where it literally threw you onto an island and said, good luck. You don't know what the objective is. You don't know how it works. All you know is how to click forward and back. And yet you began to learn the game as you went through. So this is a classic example of learning systems. What it is you put themselves in the environment it teaches. Now, what's a participatory system? Participatory system is where a bunch of different L1s get to live together. In other words, if you look at something like Flickr, I put up my photos that I understand everything. And when I tag them with my words. Right? So when I put up a picture of a kid, I say Riley, because that's my son. Or I say birthday, because that's when I took it. But when you look at that picture, you see kid, so you tag it with kid. You didn't have to learn my language. You didn't have to come up to speed. We can just use different words and they can coexist. And it turns out that when you aggregate lots and lots of these individual L1 usage of language, tagging being a classic example, you get something that's really useful. It turns out that even though I may use Riley and birthday, use kid, I use kid too. And there's utility in that. And there's a lot of overlap because we come from the same culture with the same background and the same genetic makeup. And so this is where you get utility of these systems. And so what's interesting about it, if you look at Flickr and Facebook and all this other stuff, they're really light on functionality. They don't have a lot of complex functionality to them. And people don't complain. What they have is a lot of customizability. So while I can't force this, while this thing doesn't have a wizard to walk me through doing this, I can turn it on easily and turn it off easily. I can change how it looks. I can skin it. I can do all this other stuff. Right? And so when you look at what's presented to you, it's allowing you to put your language, your understanding, your world into that system, and it coexists with lots of other worlds, and that's okay. Now, what are we doing with our language? What are these two people doing with their language? They're seeking agreements. What they're doing is, as we have a conversation, whether it's with myself, two organizations, two individuals, we're seeking an agreement. We're negotiating what we mean by certain things. So when I'm talking, I'm looking at the audience, and I'm looking for one of these, or I'm looking for one of these, or I'm looking for one of these, or I'm looking for one of these. And that's a sort of physical negotiation that's going on. Every so often I'll stop and go, does that make sense? Is that right? Right? That's a form of negotiation. That's going to be very formal. A contract is a very formal negotiation, but it's still, in essence, the same thing. What are we agreeing on with a contract? We're agreeing on the language used in the contract. And then what we do is we begin to scaffold agreements upon it. Okay, if you understand, now that I've introduced the L1, L0 world, and I'm going to pretend that you understood it, now I can use that throughout the rest of the presentation. Now you can say, I've given L1, L0, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to come up, and by the way, you can always agree to disagree. Now, what's interesting about this is where do we put them? Our brains aren't like our stacks. They're relational. They relate different things together. And so what the entailment mesh, what our memory looks like, is a collection of agreements plus their relationships. And that's really important, the plus their relationships. Right? It's dynamic. It's constantly changing. How many people have ever reread a book like 5 years later? And you're rereading the book going, what? I thought that was like a chapter. It's a page and a half. Or I didn't get what that was about. Right? It's like I read Horton, what was it? Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. I wrote it to my, read it to my 5-year-old. He's thinking about snoozles and going through little dark places, and it was given to me when I graduated with my PhD by my parents. Now, clearly they probably didn't have a high esteem for my intellect, but right, it's a 2-level book. We hear these things all the time. It's the relationships. When I'm 5, I come to a text with a whole set of world knowledge, which is relatively limited. And when I'm 35, I come to it, it's much more expanded. I can read different things into it. So, an example of that. A bunch of pictures. What's their relationship? What's this picture about? What's this collection? Is it a collection? I don't know. How can we divide it? Well, we could put girls on one side and boys on the other side. No, that screws that up. Or you could put children up here and adults up here. And all we could do, right? How do we relate these things? Now, this is a typical library science problem. Here's a collection of stuff organized. Now, these pictures don't make sense unless this is my dad, who met my mom, who had me. Oh, that's my sister. Who had then had me. So they got it right the second time. Who went off to college and met my wife, and we had Riley, and we had Andrew, and here's what we all look like today. Right? Now, what's interesting about those pictures is they now have meaning. But the meaning did not come from the pictures. The meaning came from the connections that you gave to the pictures. And what's also interesting is you could have provided different connections. And what we do in our catalogs, one gets to win. Right? That's what we do by reducing conversations down to one. We reduce the possibility of multiple conversations. That's what, in essence, classification is and why classification drives us insane. And people are going to say, well, what about mesh and all these other things? Fine, you're still working on a limited domain set.
Right? So now I could present an image like this, which is the family tree. When we try and not limit these conversations, let me give you an example. Here's the downside of doing that. Here's Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the entire screen from WorldCat. Open WorldCat, so it's about a year old. Right? That's it. Here is the same record from the Onondaga County Public Library. Read it at your leisure. National Library of Australia, Library of Congress. Now, before I go much further, how many people have been in the Our Website Sucks conversation? You've been on the Our Website Sucks committee, no doubt, where you said we need to get it better, it needs to be wonderful, etc. And it always turns like this. I haven't even been there, but I can almost guarantee at some point someone will say, it needs to be simpler, it needs to be easier, it's too complex, this language is arcane, it needs to be more like Amazon. Everyone uses Amazon, right? Let's face it, I do it, you do it, we go to Amazon to find the book, then we go to our library catalog and see if we have it. Right? All right. Simpler, easier, better. Amazon. Same book. Amazon. Amazon. What's going on here? Oh, well, it's all advertising. Okay. That top little bit of bar, which is up in the black, is navigation and branding. The next thing is sales information, which is the price, who wrote it. The next little bit are sales recommendations. If you like this, you'd also like this. Quality reviews from LJ and New York Times Book Review. Bibliographic data, ISBN number and such. By the way, you add up that orange bar, you add up that blue bar, so you're not far off from these. Okay. So what else is here? More recommendations based on purchases, and then open reviews. Pathfinders. We used to do pathfinders. Discussion tools like wikis and blogs. And only at the bottom you get other promotional material. What are they doing here? Why is this so much bigger, and I would argue potentially more useful than this? I would tell you the vast majority of the screen real estate, when you look at these, what is it? Location data. It's on this floor. It's in this building, right? It assumes you know what you want, and so now you want to go get it. This assumes you have no clue what you want, and you want to find out. Right? The location data doesn't matter. This is conversations. And what's interesting is if you look at these conversations and you read the review on Amazon, they're not really talking about that book. They're not. If you read the one on Harry Potter, it's like, boy, this was a great book because what the author did was she was able to put these little things in that didn't become useful to book two and book seven. They're talking about book two and book seven. Not talking about that. Your conversation, what's happening is Amazon made the same mistake that we did, though it makes sense for them because they sell things, which is they tried to cram all the conversation and center it on a thing, not a person, not a learning process. They did it on a book. And what's seeping out is all this conversation trying to link to all this other vast world of information, and it shows up here. By the way, those who think I'm being unfair with Harry Potter, this is the woodwork of J.J. Lankus, not related, that was published in 1990. 1990 on woodcuts. They still get this much information about it. Okay? So what does it look like if we take a system and we try and make it not look like a thing? What if we try and build systems around conversation? So we've looked at Syracuse University's online catalog, and we started thinking about the reserves. Right, so students go in, the professor supposedly has put up a bunch of books they're supposed to read for the class, they go online, they hit find a reserve, because that makes a lot of sense, and then they enter in what course they're taking, what department, and it spits back a screen that looks like this. So we took on and we said, how can we make this look cool? And we came up with this. And I'll tell you why this sucks. I'm perfectly willing to admit why my system sucks. So, we have my articles, we have my books, we have my classes, my feeds, my stuff, my friends. I have one friend. We have all this my stuff, and then, once you bring up an article, we've got the article, we've got the standard bibliographic data, they can talk to a librarian, we stole this right out of the library thing, because that's cool. Tag fob, gotta have a tag fob, tag fobs are cool. Oh, and mashup, we'll put Amazon data right in there. It's so 2.0, it stinks of it.
And we said, this is wrong. And we kept looking at it wondering why it's wrong. Because what we did was we took every 2.0 function we could find and throw it at it. We now call this the PDF glorification screen. Because think about it. Everything on there is glorifying the greater good of a PDF file. Not the person who's going to use it. Not the person who created it. Not anything about the world it's going to live in. The context that makes it useful. It's about a file. And what's the difference when a student goes into a class between a book and an article?
Well, one you usually have to go to the library to get, and one you don't. But the truth is nothing, because we're only going to use the abstract anyway.
Right? And aren't books and articles part of classes? And you know, what the heck is my stuff? Why do I need friends to know about a glorified PDF file? So we went back and we said, this is not right. And we came up with this. What we said is, if we're about conversations, if we're in the knowledge business, and we're in the conversation business, what should our systems look like? Well, they should look like entailment meshes. They should look like relationships of objects, not objects. So what we have here in a class, the first thing you need in a class is a syllabus. What is the syllabus in a class? And I'm sorry, this is an academic example. If you'd like, I can pull out a public library example. A syllabus in a class is really the first part of the conversation. It's the professor in before the class saying, this is how I think this world works. And he has not only, or she has not only what you need to do, but a little bit of why you need to do it, how it's going to be evaluated. And what it does is it links resources. So what happens when we're in an academic environment? We get this. We put up the stuff, we throw away this. This is the most important thing. Because what it talks about is the relationships of materials. And that may point to a document, and it might point to another document, but it also points to assignments. And now a student comes in and says, I'm having a bunch of conversations. Some of them are around classes, some of them are around my next novel, some of them what to do Thursday night, whatever it is. Because Friday night's too busy, and Wednesday is hard, but Thursday you can go out. What I did is, here's the assignment, here's the material I found for the assignment, here is the other materials, and I'm beginning to build a tree of relationships that have objects in them, but it's a tree of relationships. And notice what's interesting here is I've annotated the links, because this is what's really important. The objects don't have the value. Context has the value, and context sits between objects. What does that mean? That means if I have 10 books sitting here, they inherently have nothing, no value. It's only when I say these 10 books are very rare and I collect them that they gain value. That if you read this one, you've got to read this one and this one. That in between the objects is where the value is. And so when Amazon lets you create lists, or when Flickr lets you make tags, the problem is they're not letting you necessarily work in between objects. The problem with tags is that they are chronologically dependent. What that means is if you let people go tagging everything, you take the tags they assign to an object, you walk up a year later and say, what are these tags meant? They'll go, I don't know. Or what we know from human culture is they'll come up with a meaning for it even though it wasn't the original meaning. The problem with lists is you list a bunch of books. Delicious. You bookmark 300 things and you can see who else bookmarked it. Well, why did you bookmark the 300 things? What are the relationships in them? What are the subcategories? How are these things related? Lists and tags have their utility, but really we want to concentrate on what's in between these objects. Then when you bring up an object, then we can bring up the PDF glorification screen. Then it makes sense. But I need the context. And so you can imagine a student coming in here, looking at this book and saying, I'm going to put my notes in. Who else did notes on this? I'm going to see anyone else from my classroom. I can see. Suddenly I can find out this book was also used in an anthropology course. Why is the library science book being used in an anthropology course? Well, that's an interesting connection. And it's a connection they never would have found through classification. But they will find through utility, usage, and relationships that people have put in. And what you can eventually see happening is the catalog begins to migrate over to a conversational system. That where we started by looking for things, the true utility is looking for relationships and how they work together. Now, what's interesting, and one more academic example, but I'll give you a published example, is this presents an opportunity gap. Academic reward systems are all about, there's an algorithm I have for faculty, which is subdivide domain until biggest fish is achieved. Right? If you're a faculty member, the way you get tenure and promotion as a full professor is you are the biggest, most influential person in the domain you work in. So if you work in a big domain, there are lots of competition. So you start subdividing. So I'm in library science.
they're important people in library science. I'm in reference. Oh, God, yeah, you're going to be up there with Smith. All right, I'm in virtual reference. Oh, Marie Radford's in. Okay, I'm in systems for virtual reference. Okay, I'm in systems for asynchronous virtual reference that happened on the Commodore 64 on Thursday nights in 1932. Leader of my field, tenure. Right? It's all about reductionism. It's all about reductionism. And when you looked at Dewey, when he approached the public libraries and library systems, what was he doing? Reducing them. I'm taking the massive conversation and I'm subdividing and subdividing and subdividing until I get the smallest atom. I'm going into Grand Central and I'm making it static and I'm dividing people until I can organize them. What's interesting about knowing is that it's all about connections. Right? So what's interesting is whether you're in a public library, a special library, or an academic library, we're in this business. Even though we're using tools around this business. So when someone walks into a public library and says, I need help on a social service, as a municipal organization, you can begin to say, well, I'm a library, I can't help you. No, you say, I'll help you look up. Here's the 211 service, here's this shelter service, here's this public assistance service. Here we begin connecting our disconnected institutions. Academic library, well, I'm doing work in computer science, and I'm doing a classification. Oh, if you looked at this literature, and this literature, and this literature. I'm a special library. I spent a lot of time in the Department of Justice law libraries. I found out that law librarians very rarely work on the law. Which is the lawyers know the law. The lawyers come in and say, I'm about to bring out an environmental impact suit against someone where they dumped chemical X. I need the library to tell me about chemical X. I don't need them to tell me about the EPA regulation. And so suddenly, you say, well, I found you an expert witness who's going to come up. And someone else walks in and says, I have to do an abatement case around chemical X. Ah, I have an expert witness for you, and I have this data, and did you know this lawyer? And suddenly we're connecting our organizations. Libraries have all too often looked at our tools of subdividing the world out into a reductionist atmosphere and forgotten that what we do that for is to connect the world together. This is the opportunity that libraries have. This is an opportunity that leads to something that I call the Dewey level shift. This is Joan Bechtel's statement. Perhaps it is an understatement that academic libraries. When I look at a lot of the literature on change in the future of libraries, an inordinate amount of it is pragmatic. What that means is a lot of it is, what can I do now? Why are you doing Flickr? Why are you doing MySpace? Why are you doing Facebook? Well, that's where the kids are. Why are the kids there? It's that second question we never ask. Why are the kids in Facebook and Flickr and MySpace? Because it's a world they can shape. That when they come across a system, and the system doesn't look like they want it to or respond like they want it to, they leave it. Why? Because they're selfish and arrogant and want it? No! Because that's not how the world works. I mean, have you ever... How many people... you call up the help desk, and it puts you in the phone tree. And what's worse now is we know pressing 1 and 2 is passé. Now it gives you Jim or Bob or Sally, which is the computer-generated piece of crap. Right? Hi, I'm here to help you. No, you're not! Would you like to fly domestically? No, I need a refund. I think you said domestic. I did not! What's happening? The system thinks it knows what you want to do, and it's only going to let you do it. So what do? Agent, zero, please God, help me, whatever, get me a person. Because a person can shape and move and have conversation and agreement and learn my language, the system can't. So what happens when people come up to Amazon? I don't like this review. I can add my own. What happens when people add their books to library thing? I don't think this is a, military history book. I think this is a whatever. I can tag it that way. I can organize it. What happens when they come to the library catalogs? I don't know what this LC thing is. Did you know that these two books were actually part of a series? And yes, it wasn't put explicitly, it was written 20 years apart, but it's part of a series. Why can't I tell you that? We live in a world where technology has enabled people not to do things they never could before, but where technology now allows us to do natural things in a digital environment. Really different. The internet and all this new Web 2.0 and Ajax technology are not allowing us to do something fundamentally different. They're allowing us to do something fundamentally human that we haven't been able to do to this point.
When you organize your CD collections at home, you may do them alphabetically, you may do them by genre, but you get to do them. Now I can do that to the CD collection of Amazon. What about my library? We're in a world when people encounter static systems that don't speak their language, they have too many other options to waste time in it. It's not because your system is old and stodgy, people only think of libraries as books. It's because the systems don't allow them to think. It doesn't allow them to express how they see the world. Right? Why is things like Second Life and MySpace so important? Because it allows them to shape the universe around them. And you may say, oh, that's really because it's all arrogant. Or, of course, it's because people are social animals. People are basically greedy. People are greedy. People want to organize their world so it makes sense to them. It's very self-involved. It turns out that when you take that self-involved impulse, you give them the tools, and you aggregate all those self-involved impulses together, a social good is created. And that's remarkable. But let's not pretend the social good was the end or the beginning of that process. So, we're looking at a shift where we need to start talking about libraries not as collections of things. Not as collections of things. I've walked around this library, gorgeous library. The thing I was most impressed about this library was actually the place where we were having the food and the snacks, which is a bunch of empty tables with power outlets. Hello, right? Why is that? Well, because people want to be social. People want to go in and be social on their terms. They want to be in control and driving that social nature. That's why it's easier to IM someone when you run over their dog than call them on the telephone, right? It gives you, you're in control of that environment. They can't hit you from there. Let's face it, how many people have sent bad news by email because they just didn't want to face someone? That's being social? No, that's being, you're organized your world, you found tools that you're comfortable in. And so we facilitate them. So we're looking at Dewey Littleship. And I would also tell you, I was talking about this before, I'm doing a work for the MacArthur Foundation on the future of libraries. And so I've talked to academic libraries and special libraries and public libraries and what's the future. And what's remarkable is to a T, they all respond the same way. The future of libraries are about learning, education, and the physical library is still important. It becomes much more of a community center, a place where people can congregate and do things socially. Now, what's remarkable is not only do they all say that, public, they all then say, but the academic libraries are then screwed because they don't understand this. And the academic libraries above, the public libraries are screwed because they don't understand this. And the special libraries say, oh, but they're both screwed because they don't understand. And they're saying the same thing. Right? We've got to stop being the point of academic special, public special. We're all really just special. We're all our own little unique worlds, and yet we're all doing the same stuff. We've got to learn from each other. So when I say things like, libraries are perfectly situated. I don't mean academic libraries are perfectly situated or public libraries are perfectly situated. I mean libraries are perfectly situated. Why do I say we're perfectly situated for this world? Well, first, we function as authorities, not authoritarians. And I get really worried when people look at the internet and they say there's too much stuff out there. Libraries will only keep the good stuff. We say that in lots of different ways. We'll only take the published literature. We'll only take the documented human record. We'll take lots of it, but it comes down to, we're not going to take it all, we're only going to take the good stuff. And here's the trick. I'm a library professor, and I teach reference courses. And I get out the groups and I say, librarians can't pick out good stuff. People look at me very mad. I say, we don't train librarians to pick out good stuff. I said, taking a librarian and throwing them at a collection and assuming the collection will be weeded, sorted, and organized in a good way, you might as well take in the gardener outside and throw in information to him. What we train and teach librarians, what is the core of our profession, is to determine what is good stuff for a given need. That last part, for a given need, is context. We are in the context business. We're in the knowledge business. We're in the conversation business. But what that means is, I love this sign. Please, do not place anything on top of the piano, whether the piano is covered or uncovered. Thank you. And someone has scribbled in, except for this sign. Context matters. Right. I was looking through some of the beautiful collections out there in archives and pictures, and someone thought,
you know, ex-governor was the most corrupt governor in America, and the citation was Wikipedia. Well, why not? You know what the number one referred to site from Oregon Virtual Library Cooperative Services? Wikipedia. Number two site for OCLC question point. Oh, Wikipedia! Let's face it. It doesn't matter if it's Wikipedia. It matters if that article is important. And what's nice about it is it fits perfectly into here. If librarians find something wrong, we can fix it. Say that or pretend. This concept that somehow we're authoritarian, we say, this is good and this is bad, out the window, because we know that people have very different information and how they organize it, and we're in the context business. Someone walks in, a reporter walks in and wants a great website for hate groups using the web to solicit new members. We send them to the Blue Flex Land website. Eighth grader walks in, asks for after-school activities. Not the same site. Does that mean that the Ku Klux Klan is a bad site? What's the question? My son is in second grade, and they're working on the difference between facts and opinion. I'm the worst parent ever when he talks to me about fact and opinion. Well, what's the question, son? Mount Everest. How high is Mount Everest? What year? Whose measurement? Because the Chinese measure 20 meters below the rest of the world. Now, if you're a pilot, that matters. Context. And context is about connections. And context is about annotation. And context fits between items. I'm going to kind of get back to this again. We are an item-fixated universe. We're want document like objects. Fervor is brilliant if you're talking about a thing. Fervor makes no sense when you talk about reality. Right? So in 1 minute, I'm going to give you my favorite James Burke story. James Burke, a historian and BBC publisher, talked about how the North winning the U.S. Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Ready? Here it comes. The South should have won. No, there's more than that. The South should have won because they had more men. More men at the time, typical military thing, was more men on the field, you had greater chance of victory. The problem was that when they divided it, the North had, the South had more men, but was primarily agrarian. The North had fewer men, was primarily industrial. That meant they could bring more artillery to the field. More artillery then balanced it out, and the North was able to get superior military advantage. The problem with cannons is you can't face it as someone go boom, because what happens is a ballistic trajectory where it goes in an arc. So to determine where you're going to shoot and what angle you need to shoot the cannon at to get the bad guy, you actually need to understand what the area of the arc, which is calculus. And not too many Union soldiers at the time could do calculus on the fly. And so what they used to do was get a bunch of mathematicians who would come up with tables. This distance, this angle. This distance, this angle. And these tables would come with the cannon. This changed military thinking to more artillery, greater chance of victory, which followed us into World War I and World War II, where we were then beating on the Germans that had as good, if not greater, industrial capacity than we did. And so therefore, we began producing more and more of an arms race, more and more bigger cannons, and we ran out of people and time to produce these charts for the people in the field, and so we needed to automate the process. By automating it, we came out with the first digital computers that ran on vacuum tubes. The problem with vacuum tubes is they're very fragile and they can break very often, so people realized that they could get the same activity by wafering silicon together, which became a transistor, which had the added benefit of being able to shrink smaller and smaller and smaller, and we'd get thousands and millions of a head of a pin, which then led to integrated circuits, which then led to the computer central processing unit, which then led to the modern computer PC. That is not linear. Where do you classify that story? That's not about things. That's about connections. And our systems are about things. So we're honest brokers. We can facilitate these conversations. And we're the ones to handle this problem because we're ultimately tool builders. I'm a tool builder. Yes, you are. I'm a reference librarian. You ever do a Pathfinder? It's a tool. You ever classify a book? You're using a tool. You ever build a website? You're building a tool. We're tool builders. We understand this and we can build these tools. And we need to stop riding waves and become the wave machine. Because if we constantly try and beat Amazon and Google, we will lose. What we need to do is, what from our unique knowledge perspective can we build that will be the next killer app for our users? We provide connective tissue to our community, and ultimately we have an obligation to do this. We have an obligation as libraries to society to do this, to our own organizations. Brooklyn College should be a better place because the library is here. There's an obligation that sits on the Brooklyn College Library to be better. And when I say be better, I don't mean that they're horrible now.
Any dynamic system, if you sit in place long enough, you will become out of date and irrelevant. You must constantly evolve to a new reality. The yardstick, the better, is going to change every day you're alive. And we have to have an obligation to keep up. New York Public Library, Law Firm Library, Medical Library, you have the same obligations. It is our noble mission as libraries to make the communities and society that we are part of better. To do that, we need to hold on to core principles. I would argue the core principle of conversations and knowledge. And we must question tradition. I don't say throw it out. I don't say make it irrelevant. I think we should know our traditions. And then we should question them. Every one of them. Do we still need to do this? Why are we doing this? Doesn't make sense. We need to hold the visionaries to account. Someday I'm going to write my article on demagogues and deities. And the notion that I can get up here and spout, and I can be really loud and really fervent. I get you really excited about it. But you have an obligation to say, but did he say anything? Did it matter? How does it show up? How can we do something with this? Where's your data? Where's your theory? You are the future of libraries. Ultimately, whether you wiki or blog or IM or Twitter, or I don't care. It's your decision. It's not an institution's decision. The books don't make the decision. The mortar doesn't make the decision. You make the decision. And if you sit back and let other people define what the library is, they will do it from an out-of-date romantic notion centered around things. And this is a world we should not be in. You can either be changed or you can change. I don't say this to change for change's sake. A lot of there's a lot of anger in Library 2.0 language, if you've ever seen it. Change. Why? Change. Where? Change. How? Change. Wiki. Wiki. Blog. Twitter. Twitter. I blog? I do wikis? Why does it make any difference? Because you blog about the copier, right? the Portland Public Library System, Multnomah County Library, did a survey with lots of teenagers. You know what the teenagers wanted from the library? Blogs. Blogs. What they really wanted, when you break it down, is they wanted readers' advisors. They wanted to know what books were good, but they didn't just want a list. They wanted to know who said that's a good book. They wanted to know about Dave and know enough about me to understand that I think Dave's kind of cool or I think Dave's a geek or whatever it is. I'll read that book or I won't read that book. They wanted personality. They wanted connections. They wanted someone to converse with. This is our future, is our ability to engage these people. It's a glorious future that we have. It's a noble mission that we have. And so what I would ask you is that you spend the rest of the day and the rest of the weeks and the rest of the months looking at what you can do to change and incorporate newness into your library. I ask you to constantly ask the question, why? And I ask you always to ask that question, not as a way of obstructing change, but as a way of guiding positive change within your organization. And to realize that everyone in this room and everyone in your organization, from janitor to director, is charged with innovation. They're all in the innovation business. You're all in the innovation business. No one said we were done when Dewey died. Are you done? Is your field done? Are we complete? Did we figure out all the answers? Because if we did, I don't like the question. That's the role that we play. That's the conversation we need to have. Thank you very much.